tonight we were talking a lot about gratitude, gratitude for things, for people, maybe even for memories of people and places. So we'll just keep learning about gratitude together, why it's important, how to practice it, how to tell people we're grateful by doing things like writing thank you cards or just giving people a special hug, making sure we listen when they're talking, and asking curious questions to learn more about the people in our lives. Miss Leanne told us that gratitude is like a bowl that we can carry around with us when we're anxious or worried or depressed. We have this bowl of gratitude that we've put things in throughout our week. Like when we can play games with friends, when we learn a new word from a book that we like, or we finally solve that math problem that we've been trying to figure out, or we draw a picture and give it to someone that we love. All those little things can help fill up our gratitude bowl. And you know what is so important about gratitude also is that people love hearing ways that you're grateful for them, whether it's a grandparent or a parent or a teacher or a friend. People love hearing about things that they did that made you happy. So always remember to tell people things that you're grateful for about them. And the other thing that I love about gratitude is that it's free. It doesn't cost you any money to be grateful. So it's a gift. And it's a practice that you can keep doing as often as you like. At church, we like to learn about ways and different skills that we need to deal with the world around us and to grow and keep learning about ourselves. And gratitude is one of those things that we're going to keep talking and learning about. One of my favorite ministers, Reverend Elaine, she used to work at East Shore. She taught me about writing thank you cards. And she gave me an assignment once, I think, to write 10 thank you cards a month. Can you believe it? It was a little hard to keep up with, and I didn't always have the time, but I would try. And even if I could do only one or two, I still filled myself up with gratitude and sent that off to people. And they received the gratitude. In the land of Narnia, inside the wardrobe, is where we go next. We've got Edmund and Peter and Lucy and Susan. They're the four little children that have taken us through the journey. They discovered, Lucy especially, that the wardrobe in England would take them to this other land. And in this other land, they're encountering good and bad things, including a witch. Some of the children think the witch is not good. One child thinks that the witch is good, and we're about to find out more. They've just realized while talking with the beavers that Edmund, one of the four sons of Adam and daughters of Eve, a human, is gone. Peter asks, "What are we to do, Mr. Beaver?" "We must be off at once. We haven't a moment to spare. We'd better divide into four search parties and all go in different directions looking for Edmund. Whoever finds him must come back here at once." "Search party, son of Adams? What for?" "Why, to look for Edmund, of course." "There's no point of looking for him," said Mr. Beaver. "What do you mean? He can't be far away yet, and we've got to find him. And what do you mean when you say there's no use looking for him?" "There's no use looking. We already know where he's gone." Everyone stared in amazement. "Don't you understand? He's gone to her, the White Witch. He has betrayed us all." "Oh, surely. Oh, really, he couldn't have done that." "Can't he?" Mr. Beaver said, looking very hard at the three children, and everything they wanted to say died on their lips, for they each felt suddenly quite certain inside that this was exactly what Edmund had done. "But will he know the way?" said Peter. "Has he been in this country before? Has he ever been here alone?" "Yes," Lucy said in almost a whisper. "I'm afraid he has." "And did he tell you what he'd done or who he'd met?" "Well, no, he didn't." "Then mark my words," said Mr. Beaver. "He has already met the White Witch and has joined her side and been told where she lives. I didn't mention it before because he was your brother. But the moment I set eyes on him, I said to myself, treacherous. He had the look of one who has been with the witch and eaten her food. Do you remember Turkish Delight? You can always tell them if you've lived long enough in Narnia. It's something with their eyes." "All the same," said Peter, "we'll still have to go look for him. He's our brother, after all, and he's only but a kid." "Go to the witch's house," said Mrs. Beaver. "Don't you see that the only chance of saving either him or yourselves is to keep away from her?" "How do you mean?" said Lucy. "Why, all she wants is to get all four of you. She's thinking all the time of those four thrones at Caer Paravel. Once you were all four inside her house, you'd be done. There would be four new statues in her collection before you'd even have time to speak. But she'll keep him alive as long as he's the only one she's got, because she'll want to use him as bait to catch the rest of you." "Oh," said Lucy, "can no one help us?" Only Aslan. We must go and meet him. He is our only chance now. It seems to me, my dears, that it is very important to know just when he slipped away. How much he can tell her, the White Witch, depends on how much he has heard. For instance, had we started talking of Aslan before he left? If not, then we may do very well, for she won't know that Aslan has come to Narnia, or that we're meeting him, and will be quite off her guard as far as that is concerned. I don't remember his being here when we were talking about Aslan. Lucy interrupted him. Oh, yes, he was. Don't you remember? It was he who asked whether the witch couldn't turn Aslan into stone, too. So he did! Just the sort of thing he would say, too. Worse and worse, said Mr. Beaver. And the next thing is, was he still here when I told you the place for meeting Aslan was the stone table? And of course no one knew the answer to that. Because if he was, then he'd simply sledge down in that direction and get between us and the stone table and catch us on our way down. In fact, we should be cut off from Aslan. But that isn't what she'll do first. Not if I know her. The moment that Edmunds tells her we're all here, she'll set out to catch us this very night, and if he's been gone about half an hour, she'll be here in about another 20 minutes. You're right, Mrs. Beaver. We must all get away from here. There's not a moment to lose. Now, of course, you want to know about what has happened to Edmund. He had eaten his share of dinner, but he hadn't really enjoyed it because all he was thinking about was that Turkish delight. And there's nothing that spoils the taste of good, ordinary food half as much as the memory of bad magic food. And he had heard the conversation and hadn't enjoyed that much either, because he kept on thinking that the others were taking no notice of him and trying to give him the cold shoulder. They weren't, in fact, but he imagined it still. And he had listened until Mr. Beaver told them about Aslan and until he had heard the whole arrangement about the stone table. It was then he began very quietly to edge himself under the curtain which hung over the door, for the mention of Aslan gave him a mysterious and horrible feeling, just as it gave the others a mysterious and lovely feeling. Just as Mr. Beaver had been repeating the rhyme about Adam's flesh and Adam's bone, Edmund had been very quietly turning the door handle just before Mr. Beaver had begun telling them that the White Witch wasn't really human. Edmund had got outside the snow and cautiously closed the door behind him. You mustn't think that even now Edmund was quite so bad that he wanted his brothers and sisters to be turned into stone. He did want more Turkish delight, and he did want to be a prince and later a king. And he wanted to pay Peter for calling him a beast. As for what the witch would do with the others, he didn't want her to be particularly nice to him. Certainly not to put them on the same level as himself, but he managed to believe that she wouldn't do anything too bad, because all those people who say nasty things about her are only enemies, and probably half of them aren't even true. She was really nice to me anyway, much nicer than they are. I expect that she is the rightful king, he thought. Anyway, she's better than that awful Aslan. At least that was the excuse he made in his mind for doing what he wanted. It wasn't a very good excuse, however, for deep down inside, right in the center of his belly, he knew somewhere that the White Witch was bad and cruel, even if he couldn't admit it to himself. The first thing he realized when he got outside and found the snow falling all around him was that he had left his coat behind in the Beaver's house. And of course, now there was no chance of going back to get it. The next thing he realized that the daylight was almost gone, for it had been nearly 3 o'clock when they sat down to dinner, and the winter days were short. He hadn't reckoned on this, but had to make the best regardless. So he turned up his collar and shuffled across the top of the dam to the far side of the river. It was pretty bad when he reached the far side. It was growing darker every minute, And with that and the snowflake swirling all around, he could solidly see 3 feet ahead. And then too, there was no road. He kept slipping into deep drifts of snow and skidding on frozen puddles and tripping over fallen tree trunks and sliding down steep banks and barking his shins against rocks till he was wet and cold and bruised all over. The silence and the loneliness were dreadful. In fact, I really think he might have given up the whole plan and gone back and owned up and made friends with the others if he hadn't happened to say to himself, "When I'm the king of Narnia, the first thing I shall do will be to make some decent roads." And of course, that set him off thinking about being a king and all the other good things that cheered him quite up. He had just settled in his mind what sort of palace he would have and how many cars and all the cinema and where the principal railways would run and what laws he would make against beavers and dams. And he was putting on all the finishing touches to his new kingdom. And then the weather changed. First, the snow stopped. Then a wind sprang up and it became freezing cold. Finally, the clouds rolled in and the moon came out. It was a full moon, and shining on all that snow, it made everything almost as bright as day. Only the shadows were rather confusing. He would have never found his way if the moon hadn't come out by the time he got to the other river. He reached this and turned to follow it up. The little valley down which it came was much steeper and rockier than the one he had just left, and it was overgrown with bushes. Even as it was, he got wet through, for he had to stoop under the branches, and great loads of snow came sliding off onto his back. Every time this happened, he thought more and more how he hated Peter, just as if all this had been Peter's fault. But at last he came to a part where it was more level and the valley opened out. And there on the other side of the river, quite close to him, in the middle of a little plain between two hills, he saw what must be the White Witch's house. And the moon was shining brighter than ever. The house was a small castle, really. It seemed to be all towers, little towers with long pointed spires on them, sharp as needles. They look like a huge dunce's cap or a sorcerer's cap. And they shone in the moonlight and their long shadows looked strange on the snow. Edmund began to be afraid of the house, but it was too late to think of this point about turning back. He crossed the river on the ice and walked up to the house. There was nothing stirring, not the slightest sound anywhere. Even his own feet made no noise on the deep falling snow. He walked on and on, past corner after corner of the house and past turret after turret to find the door. He had to go right round to the far side before he found it. It was a huge arch, but the great iron gate stood wide open. Edmund crept up to the arch and looked inside into the courtyard, and there he saw a sight that nearly made his heart stop beating. Just inside the gate, with the moonlight shining on it, stood an enormous lion, crouched as if it was ready to spring. And Edmund stood in the shadow of the ark, afraid to go on and afraid to go back, with his knees knocking together. He stood there so long that his teeth would have been chattering with cold, even if they had not been chattering with fear. How long this really lasted, I don't know, but to Edmund, it seemed like hours. Then at last, he began to wonder why the lion was standing so still. For it hadn't moved one inch since he set his eyes on it. Edmund now ventured a little nearer. He saw from the way the lion was standing that it couldn't have been looking at him. In fact, it was staring at something else, the little dwarf who stood with his back to it about 4 feet away. Aha! When it springs at the dwarf, then will be my chance to escape. But still, the lion never moved. Nor did the dwarf. And now at last Edmund remembered what the others had said about the White Witch turning things into stone. Perhaps this was only a stone lion. Then as soon as he thought that, he noticed that the lion's back and the top of its head were covered with snow. Of course it must be a statue. No living animal would have let itself get covered in snow like that. Then, very slowly, and with his heart beating as if it would burst, he ventured to go up to the lion. Even now, he hardly dared to touch it, but at last he put his hand out, and quickly, he realized it was cold stone. The relief which Edmund felt was so great that in spite of the cold, he suddenly got warm. All over, right there, down to his toes, and at the same time there came into his head what seemed a perfectly lovely idea. Probably, he thought, this is the great lion Aslan that they were all talking about. She's caught him already and turned him into stone. So that's the end of their fine ideas about him. Pooh! Who's afraid of Aslan? And he stood there gloating over the statue lion. And presently he did something very silly. He took out a stump of lead pencil from his pocket and scribbled a mustache on the lion's upper lip, and then put a pair of spectacles on the lion and said, "Silly old Aslan, how do you like being stone? You think you're so mighty fine." But in spite of the scribbles on its face, the great stone beast still looked terrible and sad and noble, staring up at the moonlight that Edmund didn't really get out of fun of jeering it at all. He turned away and began to cross the courtyard. As he got into the middle of it, he saw that there were dozens of statues all about, standing here and there, rather as the pieces stand on a chessboard when it is halfway through a game. There were stone satyrs, stone wolves, bears and foxes, catamountains of stone. There were lovely stone shapes that looked like women and trees. There was the great shape of a centaur and a winged horse and a long, lithe creature that Edmund took to be a dragon. They all looked so strange standing there, perfectly lifelike, but also perfectly still. In the bright, cold moonlight, that it was eerie work crossing the courtyard. Right in the middle stood a huge shape like a man, but as tall as a tree, with a fierce face and a shaggy beard and a great club in its right hand. Even though that he knew that it was only a stone giant and not a live one, Edmund certainly did not like going past it. He now saw that there was a dim light showing from a doorway on the far side of the courtyard. He went to it. There was a flight of stone steps going up to an open door. Edmund went up them. Across the threshold lay a great wolf. "It's all right, it's all right," he kept saying to himself. "It's only a stone wolf. It can't hurt me." And he raised his leg to step over it when suddenly the huge creature rose, with all its hair bristling along its back, opened a great red mouth, and said in a growling voice, "Who's there? Who's there? Stand still, stranger, and tell me who you are." "If you please, sir, my name is Edmund, and I am the son of Adam that Her Majesty met in the wood the other day, and I've come to bring her news that my brother and sisters are now in Narnia, quite close in the beaver's house. She wanted to see them." "I will tell Her Majesty. Meanwhile, stand still on the threshold as you value your life." Edmund stood and waited, his fingers aching with cold and his heart pounding in his chest. And presently the gray wolf, Fenris Ulf, the chief of the witch's secret police, came bounding back and said, come in, fortunate favorite of the queen, or else not so fortunate." And Edmund went in, taking great care not to tread on the wolf's paws. He found himself in a long, gloomy hall with many pillars full of statues. The one nearest the door was a little fawn with a very sad expression on his face, and Edmund couldn't help but wondering if this might be Lucy's friend. The only light came from a single lamp, and close behind this sat the White Witch.
"I've come, Your Majesty."
"How dare you come alone?" said the witch in a terrible voice. "Did I not tell you to bring the others with you?"
"Please, Your Majesty, I've done the best I can. I've brought them quite close. They're in the little house on top of the dam just by the river with Mr. and Mrs. Beaver."
A slow, cruel smile came over the White Witch's face.
Is this all your news?
No, Your Majesty. And he decided to tell her all that he had heard before leaving the Beaver's house.
What? Aslan? Cried the witch. Aslan, is this true? If I find out that you have lied to me...
Please, I'm only repeating what they said. But the queen, who was no longer attending to him, clapped her hands, and instantly the dwarf, whom Edmund had seen before with her, appeared.
Make ready our sleigh and use the harness without bells.
Let's return to Mr. and Mrs. Beaver and the other three children. As soon as Mr. Beaver said, there's no time to lose, everyone began bundling themselves in coats, except Mrs. Beaver, who started picking up sacks and laying them on the table. Now, Mr. Beaver, just reach down that ham. And here's the packet of tea, and there's sugar, and there's matches. If someone will go get two or three loaves out of the crock over there in the corner.
What are you doing, Mrs. Beaver?
Packing a load for each of us. You didn't think we'd set out on a journey with nothing to eat, did you?
But we haven't the time. She may be here any minute.
That's what I say, said Mr. Beaver. Get along with you all. Think it over, Mr. Beaver. She can't be here for a quarter of an hour at least. But we don't we want to get as big of a start as we possibly can if we're to reach the stone table before her?
You've got to remember that, Mrs. Beaver. As soon as she looked in here and finds we're gone, she'll be off at top speed.
That she will, but we can't get there before her whatever we do, for she'll be on a sleigh and we'll be walking.
We have no hope, said Susan.
Don't get fussy. Just get half a dozen clean handkerchiefs out of that drawer.
We've got to have hope.
But we can't get there before her. We can keep under cover and go by ways she won't expect, and perhaps we can get through.
That's true enough, Mrs. Beaver. It's time we're out of this.
Don't you start fussing either, Mr. Beaver.
There, that's better. There's four loads and the smallest of us. There you go, Lucy dear.
Oh, now please do come on.
Well, I'm nearly ready now, answered Mrs. Beaver, at last allowing her husband to help her with her snow boots.
I suppose the snowing machine is too heavy to bring.
Yes, it is, Mrs. Beaver. Yes, it is.
I can't abide the thought of that witch fiddling with it and breaking it or stealing it, as likely as not.
Oh, please do hurry, said the children. And so at last, they all got outside and Mr. Beaver locked the door.
It'll delay her a bit, at least. And they set off, all carrying their loads over their shoulders.
The snow had stopped and the moon had come out when they began their journey.
They went in single file. First Mr. Beaver, then Lucy, then Peter, then Susan, and then Mrs. Beaver last of all.
Mr. Beaver led them across the dam, right on top of the riverbank, and along a rough sort of path among the trees. The sides of the valley, shining with the moonlight, towered up far above them on either side.
Best keep down here as much as possible. She'll have to keep up at the top, for you can't bring a sleigh down here.
It would have been a pretty enough scene to look at through a window from a comfortable armchair, but even as things were, Lucy enjoyed it as first. But as they went on walking and walking and walking, and as the sack she was carrying felt heavier and heavier and heavier, she began to wonder how she was going to keep up at all. She stopped looking at the dazzling brightness of the frozen river with all of its waterfalls of ice and the white masses of the treetops and the great glaring moon and the countless stars, and could only watch the little short legs of Mr. Beaver going pad, 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 pad through the snow in front of her as if they were never going to stop.
That's where we'll leave the sons of Adam and the daughters of Eve and all the friends of Narnia. with Edmund at the house of the White Witch, preparing to go and find his brother and sisters and the beavers. Thanks for tuning in for another wonderful episode reading The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the first book of the Chronicles of Narnia that take you deep within a mysterious, magical, and sometimes evil land.